Well, welcome to the October meeting of the Humanist Union of Madison. And we're, I think, going to have an interesting topic today. The Humanist magazine for September and October has the whole magazine on feminist issues and women in the humanist movement, if we could call it that, or philosophy. So Kathy Converse and Penny Eiler are going to be going over some of the material from that magazine and letting us know about that. Women have been historically less prominent, shall we say, members of the humanist community. So I'm anxious to hear what they have to say about it. So welcome.
Penny and I went through and there are six main articles in this issue. So we went through and tried to lump them together as best we could, and I'll be presenting on three, and then she'll present on the other three. The first one that I'm going to talk about is, let's deal with it, a rational response to sexual harassment in secular spheres. And the person who wrote this, Jennifer Calmanson, is a space systems engineer, a humanist celebrant, and a bottomless well of opinions. She serves on the board of directors of the American Humanist Association, the Institute for Humanist Studies, and the Washington Area Secular Humanists. Part of one of the jobs that Calmanson had was, when she was in her aeronautical space work, was that she was a trainer for an ensuing compliance with the sexual harassment policy. Interestingly, she was the only female that worked there, and given that she worked on this all-male team, she put a lot of thought into this challenge and how to complete this sexual harassment training without having all her co-workers feel threatened as males. And she was quite successful, and so what she talks about in the article is some of the reasons how she was successful with suggestions for her approach that could be used in other situations. So the first thing that she emphasized from the point one, which any group can emphasize, is that it is company, or it could be organization, policy to uphold the laws of the land, and there is a reason why these laws exist. So making it basic right off the pop that there's not a choice about this, this is something that needs to be done. And she feels that all companies and organizations, in order to grow and be able to meet their objectives, have got to provide a safe and non-threatening environment, and not just for their employees, but for their customers, for their clients, for their vendors, for their guests. Anyone they come in contact with has to feel that this is a safe environment in order for them to be successful. However, she talks about in all human interactions, if you're going to put humans together in space, there's a need for some logical filters to help people determine what behavior is acceptable. And she uses the word behavior to basically define the whole basis of what sexual harassment is. And with the behavior, she divides it into two different topics. One is quid pro quo, which just talks about, which is obvious that somebody does something in an effort to get sexual favors. And she just says point blank, this is wrong, this is illegal, this is a law enforcement issue, this isn't really part of what becomes sexual harassment policy. This is just something that has to be. So the other part, which is much more trickier to determine, is all the rest. Once you get beyond that, what's not illegal? And she defines it as basically it's when someone feels threatened or offended or intimidated by what somebody else has said or done. And it's that simple a definition. And the thing that she tried to emphasize when she was doing all this training, and any group could emphasize when they're having training, is that by implementing a sexual harassment policy, that you make the system protect everybody. It protects the women, and it protects the men, and it protects the organization. It's not something just being done for women. This is a policy that should be in place for everyone. So, after she's said and done all this, the question becomes, so how does this relate to humanism, which I assume we're interested in. And it's actually was one of her closing statements I'm putting up in the front because I think it's important to have in mind while we're talking about humanism, is sexual harassment exists in our culture. It's a fact. It can find, because it exists in our culture, it can find its way into all secular events and even those among people with enlightened thinking, progressive values, and reason-based policies. It's there. It's going to happen. Be prepared. Within humanism, the American Humanist Association and other non-theist gatherings, and from this she includes not just physical gatherings like conferences, but this includes now all the online forums and other ways that information has been exchanged. In the past year, they've been pretty feisty on this issue of sexual harassment and how to handle appropriate behavior. And this has basically come up because some women have been discussing harassment issues. So it's kind of a two-way. A lot of people are kind of mad that these women are bringing things up because they feel it's sort of airing dirty laundry, or they're being skeptics. And they really want more women to be attending, on the other hand. So they've got this problem they really kind of have to deal with if they want to get more women into the association. So the inherent problem is that they don't want anyone to feel left out. They don't want anyone, in particular women, abstaining from voting or taking action because they feel they're in a hostile environment. And they don't want the progress within the HA to be distracted by a hostile environment. Because most secular groups are considered to be welcoming to a diverse group, if or when anyone is threatened, there must be some appropriate action for them to take to ensure a fair outcome. And the final part that she talks about is kind of a however. You need to temper expectations to be realistic. Anytime you're in a public gathering, to use the example, if you're in a public gathering, you want to know where your wallet is, you want to know where your purse is. You're not going to walk alone in a dark night on a dark street. There's things that you need to have all the time about you as a person. And then she's saying that part of this, too, with sexual harassment is that you need to be aware, and you can be, by your behavior and your actions and your anticipation, you can help it to not occur. Any offending person has to be held responsible, and if anything happens it's more serious, then obviously it has to be reported to someone who's higher up, or an organizer, or if it's a severe problem, to law enforcement. So in conclusion, she basically says, sexual harassment policy is never going to be a silver bullet, but it can provide resources for victims to seek redress, and it can let offenders know that a particular type of behavior is not acceptable within your group or organization. Do you want to do comments between them?
However you like.
I don't know if anybody has any. I'm going on to another person. Anybody has any comments on her? I think, to me, she was just kind of laying out what the basic policy is and the fact that even within these secular organizations, they need to have that kind of policy. The second one that I had the pleasure of doing, sort of a joke, it's kind of a, is by Susan Jacoby. And Susan Jacoby is an author, most recently New York Times bestseller, that's should have been a clue, The Age of American Unreason About U.S. Anti-Intellectualism. Former Washington Post reporter and a quote on faith, end quote, columnist whose writing has appeared in a wide variety of national publications. She currently lives in New York City. So Susan wrote on A Woman's Place, The Dearth of Women in the Secular Movement. This was a rather long article that took some right and left turns throughout it, so it was a little bit difficult to summarize, but I will try to do it. Her premise is that there's underrepresentation of women within American secular movement. And she feels that this is something to be uncomfortable about, and she feels that it's a problem. However, a high percentage of the people within these groups don't feel that there's a problem and really don't feel there's a quote-unquote women problem in the organizations. She states, for example, that when she started doing this talking on this subject about 8 years ago, 90% of her audience would be men, and now 75% of her audience is men. So she feels that there's possibly been some change, and she does comment that she definitely is seeing some more gender equality within the under 30 age people. So that doesn't include any rest. So she goes on to theorize why this gap exists. Firstly, she's talking about that women in the U.S. and other countries are considered to be more religious and devout than men. And this goes, they've done these studies across incomes, racial groups, and education, and in general, women are more religious. I question if that means women go to church more versus women are more religious, but she didn't go into details. So she feels that secular humanism or atheism is a tough sell to women in general, which is one of the explanations why fewer women are involved in secular human and humanist groups. A second factor is many founders of these 20th century organizations when they got started were people who were within science and philosophy fields. And at that time, there were very few women in these fields. And even in the 1980s, when more women started getting into science and philosophy, generally speaking, they were working so hard to hold on to their tenuous position that they really didn't have time to be going out and joining organizations. A third fact, which to me might be a stronger fact, is that throughout that period of time of the 70s, 80s, that many women who were more progressive, and maybe women who would have been more involved in these organizations, were out there pounding the sidewalk with the ERA and other feminist movement issues. So they were putting lots of time and energy into the feminist movement rather than putting time into being in more organizations. And lastly, there's a part she talked about that women, many people, many men is what she was saying, consider women are soft. She called them soft atheists versus hard atheists. Mm-hmm. So that because maybe they're gentler in what their approach or some of the things they say and write, that they're considered.
Soft atheist is an agnostic?
She didn't quite say that, but apparently the impression is that they're not getting kind of out there in publications and out there in people's faces from a perspective in the same way, therefore they were considered as being more soft versus hard within the secular movement. And because of that, it creates less recognition for the work they're doing. The next sections in the article get somewhat rambly, but she's discussing some, I think it's a continuation of why women went in there. She discussed some of the early atheists, with a point being that they existed, that they did exist even though they weren't particularly well recognized, certainly in the 50s and 60s. And she talks about the founder of the American Atheist, Madeline Murray, had great struggles and problems and was called lots of negative names and not treated very well. And then one of the presidents of the American Humanist Association, Vashti McCollum, who was a humanist. And then also they mentioned the Freedom From Religion organization with Annie Laurie Gaylor and her mother, Ann Gaylor. But in mentioning all these and what they did and the ups and downs in their lives and careers, the point I believe she's making is that there's less credit given to women in general within the secular movement, even from a historic perspective to this day. And they feel that one of the main reasons for that is most of these women were also involved in the feminist movement. And really strong within the feminist movement, they did not want it associated with non-religion. Because they felt that if the feminist movement had this strong secular portion to it, they would lose their support of men and money. basically, support. So they had to make it seem like somehow the feminist movement was linked positively with religion. And she points out that it, even going way back to the suffrage movement and the abolitionism, that they didn't really want women speaking out in general, but they certainly didn't want women speaking out in an anti-religious way. And Bob had given me this. One of the people she talks about in the early movement is Elizabeth Cady Stanton, and she mentions that she had published this Women's Bible. And basically, what she does is she goes through various books in the Bible, the Deuteronomy. She goes through and writes portions of it, and then she goes on to explain how it's degrading to women, how it degrades women in general. So she put out this Bible, and even Susan B. Anthony wouldn't support her, and the Suffrage Association disavowed the book. So even within other women who were strongly feminist and strongly involved, nobody would even support her for coming out with this because it was anti-religious. And the author comments, Jacoby comments, that even now there's a tendency for feminists to downplay the role of secular women within the feminist movement. The next section talks a little bit on how to resolve it. She feels that within the secular movement there needs to be a resurrection of these earlier people, earlier feminists, and women who were atheist or humanist. Get them back into the picture, get them back into the movement. They feel that many young women would be attracted if they really knew this strong track record and all the things that these strong women had done way back in the 1800s on. And it might attract younger women in and into the fold, into the ranks. She thinks that we need to link the past denigration of women by conservative religion. That's a can of worms there. That within the humanist movement, we need to address worldwide issues of how women are being treated. Another one that's a tough one. And need to get more women into the organization, into the groups at the organizational level. And the most important thing that she thinks should be emphasized, which I'll say in closing, is that women's rights is not a special issue. It should not be treated by secular groups as a special issue. It's integral to the mission of those groups. And it should no longer be a special issue. It should just be kind of taken care of. So that's Susan B. Jacoby.
Yeah, I think I'd add a fourth to the list of three reasons. That is the male dominance in the clergy.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Yep. But I mean, she does make good points. She has, it's very rambling flight of ideas throughout much of it. I had to read it about 15 times to be able to figure it out. But I think she's making some good points, and I think it is a good point that we do need to respect and honor the work that's done by people that have gone before, get it in there.
Yeah, I think one could put it simply, women's rights are human rights. Are we talking about human rights? We're automatically talking about half of the human population of the world. And that's the approach that should be taken.
Yep. The final one is just one of these shorter end insert articles, and essentially this is by Cleo Kokel, who's with the Feminist Caucus of the American Humanist Association. Basically what it talks about is back in 1977 within the AHA they started a women's caucus, and it was basically because there were quite a few people who were not happy, particularly with what they felt was gender bias language in a lot of the writings, and lots of little picky details like people's name had Mrs. in front of it on their name tags. We aren't going to go there. But so anyway, they did start this group, and it did continue. And in the 1980s, they changed the name from the Women's Caucus to the Feminist Caucus because they hoped that it would engage more men to be involved. If it didn't sound like it was a women's group, it was more of a concern. And despite the majority of the people within the organization not really wanting this change, with the majority again being men. They did represent the AHA in marches for women's rights, Roe versus Wade, Humanist Heroine Awards for people involved with abortion rights advocates, anti-war activists, freedom from religion folks. So they did keep moving ahead and having the AHA represented in many of these very important movements. And the point they continue to make is that they're not at war with men, they're at war with history. Mm-hmm. And currently they're working, their two current goals of this feminist caucus is to refocus on passing ERA and promote Universal Declaration of Human Rights, which is what you mentioned. I just wanted to read one quick thing. It's just saying, perhaps the single most essential task we have before us is humanists, because obviously we cannot fulfill our true human potential while one half of humanity is suppressed, restricted, and demeaned, which follows what she said. And those are my three papers. Does anybody have any? Anybody have any questions or comments before Penny starts with some of hers?
I'm that middle woman. I forget what her name was.
Susan Jacoby?
Yeah. She's drawing a lot of assumptions, like the idea that, I forget that we talked about, something about religion or going to church and not speaking up because of...
Well, there was one that was talking about it's important that we don't have people within our groups and organizations who are not, don't feel free to speak up and say what they think or feel because it's a hostile environment toward them. That was in the sexual harassment one, that people need to feel free to be able to speak out.
I just thought a lot of the things that she said were based on kind of fallacious thinking, not deep enough thinking.
The article had some places where it floated pretty close to the surface, but
was it in Jacoby's article that one of the ones that I read talked about how there were more women in the humanist movement, and when you got to the I was thinking of the the word just flew right out of my head. The skeptics. What I was looking for. Yes. The skeptics. That there were even fewer women in the skeptic. Yes. Skeptics.
She said basically umbrella. The skeptic within the skeptic organizations, they were male dominated and much more religious was the comment, which is kind of a rather encompassing comment.
Yeah.
I thought Susan would like that.
Okay. No, it's true.
It's true.
You see fewer women in the skeptics.
Well, they're going to the skeptics union. It's a bunch of old scientist guys getting together and just throwing a fit because of the bad science going out there. And I don't think it's changed since then. A bunch of scientist guys infighting with each other.
Okay. One of the articles I read was The Return of the Welfare Queen by, and excuse me for butchering her name, but Sikivu Hutchinson, who is the author of Moral Combat, Black Atheists, Gender Politics, and the Values of War, and the forthcoming Godless America, Race and Religious Rebels. And she contends that in today's political climate, Reagan's welfare queen is reappearing. Recently, the LA Times ended a long hiatus they had on feature stories about black women. And in a nod to the ultra-conservatives, they did a feature on an unwed black mother of four from a long line of single mothers. And all this hand-wringing over black single mothers, while reality TV gives Bristol Palin not only a pass, but celebrates her. Hutchinson says that alums from her women's leadership project, which I think is kind of a mentoring program, I got from the gist of it, a mentoring program for young women of color, was they are overly familiar with the validation pregnancy supposedly provides working class young women of color, inundated with media propaganda that hypersexualizes black and Latina bodies and demonizes abortion. And she goes on about racial disparities. And she says in today's economy, living wages, jobs are no longer available to high school grads. There is little help for children who want to go to college. She says, and I quote, small evangelical storefronts grossly outnumber living wage job centers in East LA. The war on drugs has increased prison sentences, and studies have shown that the darker a woman's skin, the longer the prison sentence, which just is crazy. And that with 20% of black women employed by the public sector, they have been disproportionately affected by the gutting of public sector jobs, like our very own Scott Walker has been doing. Hutchinson quotes a Washington Post and Kaiser Family Foundation study that found that African-American women have the highest religious affiliation among all racial and gender subgroups, and that church membership for all women of any race in their roles as mothers is one place where they can get support. And for a mother to be a non-theist, she risks being labeled a slut, a fallen woman, or a bad mother. And these are labels that men don't encounter, so they're, it's easier for them to be a humanist because of society's labels. The article began with a quote from Barbara Smith's book, Homegirls, a Black Feminist Anthology. The quote is, the percentage of white feminists who are concerned about racism is still a minority of the movement. And even with this minority, those who are personally sensitive and completely serious about formulating an activist challenge to racism are fewer still. And I have to comment as an aside, while I understand this, for me it's not helpful to be told that I don't care without telling me what I can do different. I was reminded of a Parenthood episode I saw last week where a black child heard a rapper use the N-word. The white father tried to explain what it meant to the black community, but the black mother insisted he lacked the experience to do the subject justice. I think we all have to deal with issues from our experience, and that we need to educate others about our experience. While white feminists appreciate any help men can give us, we don't expect them to be as fervent in the fight for sexual equality as we are. I hope Hutchinson can afford white feminists the same expectation. That said, I agree with her in her quote that racial intersectionality demands that the movement, non-theism, go beyond the canned mantra of religion versus science towards an anti-racist, anti-sexist, and anti-heterosexist vision of secular social justice. Okay.
That's a mouthful.
I know, I mean, that was, yeah. That made reading the subject really fun.
Read that again, would you?
Okay.
Can you explain that in your own words?
Well, she says that the humanist movement has to be concerned about more than the religion versus science. We have to include the work for social justice and the anti-racist, anti-sexist, and anti-heterosexist concerns, whatever. Okay.
Well, it makes sense. I mean, humanism is a broad concept. Mm-hmm. It isn't just anti-theism. Mm-hmm. I mean, when we're talking about human beings, we're talking about everybody. And that means it includes a lot more than sometimes is indicated there.
Yeah. I read the Steinem interview, and while it was very interesting, it was a lot of, it covered a lot of ground on a lot of different topics. And her answers for most topics were pretty much what you would expect from Gloria Steinem. No big shock. The big thing I got out of Steinem's interview is that until person experienced what being on the lower rung of a hierarchical ladder is, they can't relate to another person's grievances. That's why it's so hard for privileged white men to understand. Well. Yeah. Yeah. Exactly. And this is a personal note. Back in my days when I was a Sunday school teacher, we were trying to teach the kids about apartheid in South Africa. And we had the children write a letter to President Reagan to ask him to intervene on behalf of a tortured activist. And I knew one short boy had internalized the lesson when he wrote that someone shouldn't suffer because of the color of their skin or their height. Okay. Part of the interview that I found maybe a little less unexpected and maybe more current was Annie Laura Gaylor had submitted a question about how the Arab Spring has affected women. And Steinem answered, "The Arab Spring did a great deal for women because the person who spread the word in the first place was a woman. Women participated in it. They were fully out there in the street. And Narwhal el-Sadari is a founding figure of Egyptian and Middle Eastern feminism who wrote a book opposing female genital mutilation, of which she is a victim. She's been banned, she's been imprisoned. She is now in her 80s, and during the Arab Spring, she was like a wise woman of Liberation Square, sitting in the middle of it as young women and men came to her for instruction, for blessing, and so on. But it's very often the case with revolutionary movements that women are present, but they are drummed out of it afterwards. The worst case in my memory was the Algerian revolution, because the women was so much a part of that. And they were told that when the French were gone, everything would be fine. But actually what happened was the re-Islamization of culture to the degree that the suicide rate among women went up dramatically. It was incredible. To some extent, we don't know yet what will become of the Arab Spring. And the final exchange I thought was probably the most pointed thing towards humanism. The question, going back to our discussion of self-identifier, there's a lot of talk within the secular movement about reclaiming the word atheist. Steinem, if it were up to me, I would not define myself by the absence of something. Theist is a behavior. So with atheist, you're defining yourself by the absence of something. I think human beings work on yes, not on no. The humanist. So humanist is sort of a beautiful term then? Steinem. Yes, humanism is a great term. Humanist. Do you consider yourself a humanist? Yes, a humanist, except that humanist sometimes is seen as, is not seen as inclusive of spirituality. To me, spirituality is the opposite of religion. It is a belief that all living things share some common value. So I would include the word spiritual just because it feels more inclusive to me. Native Americans do this when they offer thanks to Mother Earth and praise the interconnectedness of the two-legged and the four-legged, the feathered and the clawed, and so on. It's lovely. The humanists. So we need to be more positive and inclusive. So we need a more positive and inclusive term, Steinem. Yes, because it is not about not believing. It's about rejecting a God who looks like the ruling class, the humanist. Some people call themselves post-theological, which is kind of a mouthful, Steinem. It's kind of great, though. I like to say that the last 5 to 10,000 years have been an experiment that failed, and now it's time to declare the first meeting of the post-patriarchal, post-racial, post-nationalist age. So let's add post-theological. Why not? Okay. Does anybody have any comments on either of those? I forgot to. I'm rushing on here. Okay. The last article was very short and can be briefly summarized. It was by Greta Christina, a widely read and well-respected atheist blogger. She talked about how confrontationalism can open doors. And basically, it's a story about her going in for her morning coffee and taking her $20 bill to pay, and she marks out, "In God we trust," hands it to the barista, and the barista sort of says, "Whatever floats your boat," and goes away. And so while she's waiting for her coffee, she has second thoughts about, you know, being confrontational. But as it turns out, when the barista comes back, she asks why she did it. And the author has a chance to explain, you know, that the government has no business promoting religion. And the barista comes to understand that, yeah, maybe she's got a point. Which, for me, reflected back to the very, very first article, which wasn't one of them we included, but was kind of almost a eulogy for Florence Kennedy. And to quote her, "You've got to rattle your cage a door. You've got to let them know that you're in there and that you want out. Make noise, cause trouble. You may not win right away, but you should have a lot more fun."
Yeah, that's Mother Jones for you.
This is Florence Kennedy.
Yeah, no, I know, but I mean, I'm thinking of Mother Jones, of course. Yeah.
Same philosophy, yeah. Rattle the cage.
Very much, and have fun and doing fun. It.
Yeah.
The introduction from Kathy, I guess, seemed to imply something that didn't show up in any of the six articles, and it reminds me of a blog article that I read yesterday. The Huffington Post ended up picking up, talking about the absence of women in the atheist movement. Mm-hmm. So I read it. And this is about a blogger from Seattle who had written a blog something to the effect of, all right, one of the supreme Muslim leaders had said that all of the problems are caused by women wearing provocative clothes. And so she proposed on a blog that it be tested. So the women of the world should all wear skimpy clothes on day X.
Wasn't that Jennifer?
To see what happens.
Why not just go without clothes?
Yeah, well, I didn't read the original blog.
Well, that needs to apply to the men, too.
But the result of this, apparently, is that every time she now appears for a speaking event, the sexism comes out, and all they want to talk about is being naked, rather than being an atheist. And so I think that the introduction implied that there's overt sexism amongst atheists and humanists, just as there is in the rest of society. I don't think we can discount that theory. And apparently she has decided to stop blogging for a while just to let things cool. But I found it to be an interesting article.
Yeah. And where did you find this blog?
It was on one of the little blogs on Huffington Post yesterday.
Oh, is it on the internet?
Yeah.
Oh, I see.
Okay. I can find it again, but I don't have, I don't remember the woman's name. It was a blog, it was an article about her.
Oh,
yes, I think her name is Jen McCrate.
Jen. Yes. Because I heard Jennifer before, I think. No, that's not her. Jennifer. Yes.
There's definite among other groups, too. I mean, you see FFRF, if you read the hate mail after Lori Ann Gaylor comes out with something,
yeah,
it is nasty. Whereas if her hubby comes out with something, you know, it's not very good, but it's not nearly as nasty as what Lori Ann did. Yeah.
But in this instance, the comment was that the response within atheist and humanist meetings where she would appear was overtly sexist.
The editor's note in this magazine, she started, her second sentence is a quote from Zelda Gatuski saying, "We are at war with history, a history defined by a patriarchy so tenacious and entrenched, it feels almost dangerous to say the word aloud." Mm-hmm. And, you know, we're all, I think, very much still creatures of that patriarchal heritage.
I'm wondering about history going back farther. I have a feeling that there are a lot more matriarchies within our, say, our Western or our European traditions, maybe, leaving out the Eastern Orient, whatever. That few hundred years.
I want to think that, and I remember looking for evidence of that, never finding very much.
The matriarchies are not Western.
Queens and empresses and so on.
Yeah, but those were not matriarchies.
Prehistory.
I'm completely ignorant of it.
But interestingly, if you do go to history, and I think you should all go back, we should all go back to history. During the Baroque time in Europe, particularly in Germany, there was the so-called Baroque Machtweib, the Baroque power women. And this was during a time, I think it was just by parallel with the literature during the 30 Years' War. And there was a succession of extremely ruthless and extremely powerful women, like Agrippina, for example, just a name that comes to mind. But those were times that were, of course, they were power women. They had their slaves and their underlings. And that didn't mean that the low-class women were powerful. But there was really a profusion of these powerful Baroque women. And the literature is full of that. It happens that I studied literature. And also had to do with the 30 Years' War and so forth.
Well, there were probably a minority, if you looked at the bigger picture of the
it was still regional patriarchy.
These were instead of male rulers, there were women rulers.
But I mean, the whole society around them.
They abused the low class, the poor women.
It's still hierarchical.
Yeah, it's still a hierarchical class society. I mean, most of everything has to do with class, as far as I'm concerned. Even what we call races, mostly, or at least half class.
Yeah.
I wanted to go back and comment on, follow up on Al's comment with the Gaylers, because there have been some differences discussed relative to Annie and her mother Anne. And in here in the Jacoby article, she mentions that she was getting an award from the Freedom from Religion Foundation. And when she mentioned it to, she said, "When I told a man who's a well-known figure in the secular movement that I was receiving this reward, he said, 'The Gaylor women have done a lot for this movement by showing that a female atheist doesn't have to sound and look like a shrill bitch.' He considered this a compliment."
And that, that reinforces what I was saying.
Kathy, question.
Oh, I was just going to say that I was encouraged by what you mentioned in the Susan Jacoby article about the next generation of women, the women under 30 who are in that age group now, because I think it has taken a couple of generations at least for changes to come through the feminist movement. And I think the younger women are so much more tolerant of differences of any sort, whether it's sexual orientation or race or whatever it is, or gender. And I was just encouraged by the fact that there could be more representation in atheist groups as they become aware that there are those opportunities available.
And going along with that, I was reading back in an article, was talking about some of the current concerns with the pro-life and pro-choice, and one of the things they're saying, it confirms that, because so many of the young people assume so many things that have always been there. There's always been birth control, there's always been options.
But they're not
very actively wanting to engage in this at a time in which, as we all know, Roe versus Wade and other legislation is under threat, but these young women are like, I don't get it. You know, what's the problem?
Yeah. Because they don't realize how fragile the
right.
I mean,
how fragile
because
the rights are.
We never actually got the ERA passed. All of these laws, all of these laws are just so tenuous.
No,
yes,
needed the majority.
We can snatch defeat from the jaws of victory and a snap.
Yep.
You see the article on childhood immunizations in Parade magazine today for the same kind of. Oh, we don't have those diseases, so we don't need to get kids immunized. Same problem.
Right, they don't realize that you have to have a certain critical level mass of the population immunized to protect everybody.
Right.
And we're rapidly slipping below that, witness the pertussis epidemic that we just had.
I have a child in Alaska who goes to Africa where he has other family members. And he's not immunized.
Well, I didn't mean to change the topic.
But you're right. There's
the issue of
not knowing history.
The dominance of the problem is reduced, and therefore we don't pay attention.
Yeah. Right. Yeah.
But the increase in contact is greater.
Mm-hmm. That's right.
Mm-hmm. Has anybody seen the movie Steel-Jawed Angels?
Yes. No.
Want to say something about that?
Oh, well, let me see.
Is that the original one?
It's been a while since I saw it. and I'm losing the name of the woman who was it about, what it was about, but it was about the suffragettes and the struggle for women's suffrage in the United States, and they were put in jail, and they went on hunger strikes, and then they were force-fed, hence
the
steel-jawed angels. So. Mm-hmm. Darn it, I can't remember the names of the women who were being presented in the movie.
I know it's available from the library.
Yeah, no, it is with the movie.
DVD.
Yeah,
I wondered if people would be interested in arranging a showing of that.
Yeah.
Well, this is what Margaret Sanger then came into.
Yeah. She was earlier, wasn't she?
I don't know.
A little bit earlier?
Do I get this mixed up? But I know she was so important for that.
Uh-huh.
Really?
Margaret Sanger.
Susan B. Anthony.
Yeah, I think she was.
Who's Margaret Sanger is one of the very early, very powerful suffragettes and women's rights women.
Well, she was the advocate for birth control, right?
Birth control, right? Yeah. In fact, I learned
about
her.
I thought she was in her 20s.
Yeah.
Oh,
yeah.
I learned about her from my mom in Germany.
Yeah.
So.
Someone's trained.
I don't recall the name of the individuals they were playing, but I know Hilary Swank was one of them.
Right.
Oh,
yeah.
But I don't remember the
name. Yeah.
I remember reading about it.
I have a comment saying that sexual harassment exists. It's something we have to accept. I think for me, the challenge is being a man, how to be acknowledged by sexuality but be appropriate and respectful.
Mm-hmm.
That's, I think, the struggle. I mean, sex is a reality too, so we have to somehow acknowledge that and not say, well, it's not an issue. That's what's caused the problem, because I'm a sexual being.
Yeah.
So how do I express that appropriately? For me, I think, is the ultimate challenge for men, anyway.
Yeah.
And for me,
That's the key question. What's appropriate behavior and what's inappropriate?
Yeah. I had a question. I was interested in hearing from women who are a little bit older than me. Now, I'm nearly 50, and I'm very conscious of having grown up in the aftermath of the sexual revolution and having to navigate a world in which nobody knew what the rules were, and where things that meant one thing to people in my generation meant something different if I was talking to a man in an older generation. So I'm very curious whether you all experience sexual harassment as a problem in your, you know, professional and organizational and what have you lives.
I did. It's kind of a strange kind. There was this
God, he wasn't a very tall man, but he was a very big bellied man. And whenever I had to pass through the area where he was in the department, mm-hmm. he would stand in doorways in such a way that I could not get by him unless I squeezed against his butt. And I wouldn't do that, and he did it all the time, and then he'd laugh, and the co-workers would laugh. And
that's pretty brave. Funny.
Yeah. I always held off until he decided he was bored with it. But there was nobody talking about sexual harassment at all.
I haven't had any first-hand experience, but a good friend of ours, but during probably the same general period of time, worked as an assistant to the man who ran the graveyard here, the big one, Edison, the great big one here at Hoyt Park, where I lived. And she had the same sort of problem with him. And she got paid pretty well. She wanted to keep her job, because it was her first job, and she was doing okay. And finally, after 6 months or so of this, she just quit. She couldn't stand it. It's just horrible. But that was quite typical, I think, of those days. This is probably 40 years ago.
I think one thing that changed a great deal within the workplace was any type of work interviews, job interviews, things that people couldn't ask you. I was asked many times when my early profession, I was a nurse, I would be asked, when are you planning on getting married? And then after I was married, when are you planning on getting pregnant? Are you going to be getting pregnant in the next year? They would ask those questions during job interviews to decide if they wanted to hire you or not.
Absolutely. Now and then blatantly illegal.
They could ask you any number of deeply personal questions that they wanted to. Well, what does your husband do for work? What hours does he work? You know, these kind of things that they obviously could affect how you did your job. But that would be one big thing that I found is just totally different now. Having worked the last 25 years for federal government, and I know very well all the things you do not ever ask. Now you can't even know someone's, barely know their, they don't even put age and race, gender, anything on applications within the federal government.
I worked for a company, this was as recent as 6 years ago, that the parent company purchased another company, and they moved their offices something like 100 miles. So that, as it turned out, we found out later, was in order to eliminate a lot of the women, because they considered their jobs, I can't think of the word, because it was used, but they assumed that they were a supplemental, that's what it was. They considered them as being supplemental incomes, so that they probably would not move because their husbands had jobs where they were, but for them to commute 100 miles, they probably wouldn't move with the company. And like I say, that was less than 10 years ago.
I had a wage dispute too, though I did not win. I was told that I could not be paid as much as I was worth, because the guy below me had a family.
I bet you had a family too.
I have an interesting one that goes back to the very early 60s. And I was on an hourly job, but I was expected to come in and work lots of extra hours. But then I was treated as if, well, no, you only get paid for so many hours in a week. So I checked with the state to see if that was a problem, and there was some kind of discrimination, because the women that worked there didn't have that problem. And at the time in Oregon, the law only protected women on that issue.
I've had some interesting and peculiar discrimination. One time, very importantly in Germany, discrimination by my boss woman. And in fact, twice I was discriminated by women who had more power than I did. Once here in the States at the university, and then once when I was a freelance radio journalist in Germany, and I would have stayed, and I wanted to get a more definite position. And she wrote, she was interested in me, and there was a guy who interviewed me, but she was the boss of the Department of Women's Studies at the radio station. And I finally got the letter in writing from her, this was in the 80s, that she wrote very politely, but she was sorry to have to tell me I wouldn't get the job. We did hire the younger woman. And at that time, you couldn't have done that in this country. But then, of course, I encountered some stuff like this from some power women. One at the university here in this country, they wouldn't say it out loud, but they would act so that you knew what was happening there. So, it's just all over the place, you know.
I was working in the reference department here at the Memorial Library, and it was a temporary job, but they had a position to fill, and I had applied, and I overheard the husband of one of the other reference librarians say, "She's too old."
Oh, yeah.
I knew they were talking.
Oh, yeah.
So this is age discrimination.
It's a lot of what you're saying, it sounds like harassment that was aimed at driving you out of the workplace, as opposed to...
But I think it was for fun, too.
To be a bully on purpose, as opposed to try to strike up a relationship with you in a serious kind of way. So it sort of seems to me like in the atheist movement at the moment, there's two problems, and I don't know how much they're linked. It's an interesting question how much they're linked. There are young men who don't know how to approach women, and I don't know. Society's kind of in flux about how you do that. And then there's a kind of an overflow from academia, and I grew up around, you know, academic men and women, and I know how academic men of a certain generation talk, and they kind of think women are stupid sometimes, and I think there are some of these guys in the atheist movement, and that makes it very uncomfortable to have any ideas and speak up, because you know these guys are looking at you thinking that you're stupid.
The atheist skeptics that I've seen, goes directly to that quote she had with Annie Boy Gaylor, where they say, "Oh, this is a nice woman who can talk without sounding like a total bitch." And I think that's a big one, both the atheists and the skeptics unions, is that with men, you got Christopher Hitchens, who can sound like a total in the blank, and people adore him, but you get a woman doing that sort of thing.
That exact same thing.
She's being too nasty, she's being too argumentative, she's being too, et cetera, et cetera. I think that's what you get more with the atheists and the skeptics.
I think
they know better. It's just that, you know, it's almost so ingrained in this culture, they can do it anyway.
Right. When we were at the Humanist Union meeting in Boston, they have these little short sessions, and they were almost all done by men. They were very sort of academic, dry as dust.
This is Boston you're talking about.
And most of them were done by men. And there was were there more than this? That one woman, that Canadian woman. I'm trying to remember. Anyway, there was one Canadian woman who spoke, and she was also dry as dust. It was like she felt like she had to keep this incredibly kind of academic, intellectual flavor of the topic. She couldn't break away from that, because then she would not fit in with how everybody else sounded. She had a fascinating topic. It was something I knew about, and I thought, how can you take such a really interesting subject that makes it so dull?
It's easy for somebody who's really trained in the only academics.
Yes.
I ran into that coming from journalism.
Right.
My students loved it, but when you had to get points for doing an academic lecture, you ran into this kind of dust.
It's still prevalent too, that girls think they should be sound less smart than boys.
Yeah.
It's still around.
Yeah, well, this was less smart, it was less boring.
There's also the backlash on popularizing anything. That still exists today. Anybody who's going on popularization. I mean, in the old days with Martin Gardner and those guys, and it still goes on today. If you try to popularize any of your fields, there's sort of still a lot of backlash going on with that. So you can get men and women and everything else trying to do more feeding the masses or something like that.
And in that meeting, I would say that there were more young women than older women in attendance. I mean, there were certainly women. There were a lot of students there because it was by, you know, there were a lot of Harvard students. Mm-hmm. But there were definitely, I think, more men and more younger women than older women. Galen's trying to say something.
I wonder if I could shift the subject just a little bit to something that was already touched on, but I think it's particularly pertinent. We have to realize that most of the program today, this whole discussion, is appropriate to our particular society, the Western world in general, the United States and various European countries, but not to many other societies in the world, and specifically the Muslim-dominated societies, which are affecting all of us so much these days in the Middle East and Indonesia and so on, where frequently the laws are written in a way that give the women no rights whatsoever. The men are given complete control over the women. And as all of you know, that leads to lots and lots of horrific things that are done to women in those parts of the world, and it's legal. And of course that has to do with religion. It's a different religion.
And culture,
yeah, and it varies an awful lot. I don't know if you've been watching any of you, there's a series that PBS has been doing on
television. The Sky.
Yeah. What?
Half of the Sky series. Did you see that? Oh, I mean, I saw it.
Yeah, it's very, very, very good. Oh, yeah. But one of what happens in various countries around the world, they aren't all Muslim dominated either, is extremely varied. It all depends on where you are. And one of the examples was very, very striking. It was in Kenya, where there's a group of women who have formed their own little town in order to escape being completely dominated by the men. And it's amazing. They're down in the flat region where all the wildlife is, and way out in the middle of nowhere. And they have a very tenuous life there because they frequently are, and they have men coming around and beating up women on them in there, and they make a living making these absolutely gorgeous beadwork ornaments, which they sell, and that's a very tenuous living. But anyway, that's just one example of about, I don't know, 20 or 30 different examples of that program. Each one is unique and different.
Well, I suppose we better bring this to a close. I want to thank Penny and Kathy for doing that. That was really interesting. Thank you so much.
Yes.